Well, that was a nice break. I got some good snacks and coffee, and we're ready to go again. And I think we decided last night, I don't know how I get to have to start, but Bob talked me into that, to try and describe the solution. But that is an interesting word. The solution. And so I thought I'd start by telling you a story. And it's about a guy named Joe. And he's about 30 years old. And ever since he was born, he has felt not right in his skin. And he's just filled with anxiety. He's afraid of things. He doesn't feel the same as anybody. He just doesn't fit in anywhere, not in his family, in society. But he's trying to hang on. He's keeping his job. He's afraid to ask girls out. He can't dance. He just has that feeling like, man, is it hard to just be alive? And has that burden of being so uncomfortable in his own skin got greater and greater. You know, by the time you're 30, if you've just been handling this all your life, you're just almost desperate. And sometimes the idea of maybe I should just jump off a bridge or something. And he's talking to his friend, and he said, I know a guy named Ralph. I don't know why, but something tells me to talk to this. You ought to talk to him. I want you to get together with him. And so he goes over and sees Ralph. And they're sitting in the kitchen at Ralph's place. And Ralph is going, now tell me about yourself. And he told him about him. He said, oh, man. He said, that's me. He said, I was just like that. And he said, there is a solution to this. He said, have you ever tried drinking? And he said, no, my parents were teetotalers, and they told me when I was a little boy that if I ever drank, my hair would fall out, I would go blind.
Masturbation.
Yeah. That no one would ever talk to me again, and it would be the end of the world, and so I don't, no, I'm not, no, I'm not interested in that. And he reached under the table, and he took out a bottle of scotch and he put it on the table and he said, I'm telling you right now, there is a solution and it's right here. He said, for about 90% of the people in this country, when they drink, it's just another event. It's just like having a donut. It's not a major thing. But he said, there's 10% of us that have something happen when we drink that is absolutely remarkable. And the guy's going, oh, come on. I'm, you know, what are you talking about? He said, the type of problem that you have, the only way out of it is to have an awakening. There's no other way for you to achieve this. You're trying to go through life on your own. You're being overpowered by life. And what you need is something bigger than yourself. And I'm telling you, it's here. So what you need to do is to get rid of those old ideas. You thought those ideas up when you were a kid. And you're a grown-up now. You've got to rethink these things. I need you to get an open mind. I want you to try this. And he's going, no, I'm not going to do that. That stuff, I know, my parents told me that, and I'm not going to do that, and I'm not interested. And he said, well, let me read something out of here about what an awakening is, and maybe this will help you with your thoughts. It says, when you have an awakening, the most important meaning is that you will now be able to do, feel, and believe that which you could not believe before on your unaided strength and resources alone. you will be granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. You will be set on a path which will tell you you're really going somewhere. That life is not a dead end. Not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, you will be transformed because you will have laid hold of a source of strength which in one way or another you have hitherto denied yourself. You will find yourself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love which you thought yourself quite incapable. What you will receive is a free gift, and yet, at least in some small part, you have to make yourself ready to receive it. And so when we talk about you starting to drink this wonderful answer, we call it a spirit. That's what this liquid is called, is a spirit. And this is a solution to your problems. If you will do what I suggest to you, you will know how to dance. You will not be afraid to ask girls out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you something. If you start drinking this bottle of scotch, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. You are going to know a new freedom and a happiness. You will not regret the past. You will comprehend the word serenity and you will know peace. And the guy's looking at the bottle and he's just going, what? I'm not through. You will intuitively know how to handle everything. And the man says, I think those are rather extravagant promises myself. And he said, no, they're not. All of these will come true, but you have to work for them. I'm going to tell you something about this before you start. Half measures will avail you nothing. Sippers do not make it in our program. You must completely abandon yourself to this bottle. You must take the idea that somehow you can exist without this, and that idea has to be smashed. You have to surrender absolutely, and these great things will come to pass. And the guy looked at it and looked at it, and he said, can I get you a glass? Are you ready? So I got to think it over. I got to think it over. I got to think it over. And I don't want to rush into something like that. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, here's my card. If you ever get desperate enough, give me a call. So he went back out and got in the car with his friend. He said, how'd it go? He said, that guy is weird. I mean, you're not going to believe. You know what he told me? He said, we would be walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. That I would be on a path. He said, it's way too wild. It's impossible. That nothing like that could happen. I mean, that's just out of the question. And so he went home and he went on with his life. And for the rest of his life, he stayed anxious. He stayed afraid. He endured the pain of living on his own and staying with his old ideas. He just endured it. And finally, at age 60, he was ready to die. And his wife was by his side. And she saw him drift off. And then when he came back, she said, where were you? He said, I was just thinking about that time I sat with that guy about 30 years ago. He said, I wonder if my life would have been any different had I taken that drink. And then he died. And so we go, now what's the point of that story? Well, we come in here and we're told about this thing. We're told this great story we're told about this incredible solution. And our ego says, no way. No way am I going to be walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. When I was a little kid, I saw a cross and it told me, no way could this remarkable an event come to pass in my life. Those are extravagant promises. I mean, what are we talking about here of that magnitude of an awakening and a contact and a transformation? And we go back and there's the entire program is captured in one sentence in the chapter to the agnostic. And it's talking about our big book. And it said, the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, and then comes the most important part of the sentence, which will solve your problems. What? So there it is. There is the solution. Find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems. Now, how does it solve your problems? When we're near this power, there are no problems. That's how it solves them. The solution is not a traditional one that we're accustomed to seeing. What the man told the other man about the alcohol, the spirit, is exactly true. These things happen in the words that are used. Look at the verbs in the promises. Can you imagine going to a psychiatrist? And he says, oh, yes, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. All I do is think about myself. Well, don't worry, I'm going to talk to you a little while and self-seeking will slip away. I know you're all worried about money and all that stuff. Don't worry, it's going to leave you. It'll just leave you. There's no plan to get any money. There's no nothing. Don't worry, it's just going to leave you. These are spiritual verbs. These are verbs that are only used when there's a higher power involved. This isn't a normal solution. Somebody told me I could have fear of economic insecurity leave me with no money arriving. That doesn't seem possible, does it? That is beyond the realm. So when it says finding a power greater than ourselves which will solve our problems, this is what is happening. We actually are placed in a position of neutrality. The problem doesn't exist for us. It simply doesn't exist as long as we maintain our spiritual condition. So the entire solution is the spiritual condition. It is the solution itself. It's the answer to everything. Before we came to AA, we had one solution to everything. Do you ever remember drinking and, I mean, having a problem and go, oh, here's a problem I won't be drinking over. I'll be handling this one sober. No. The first thing we did when a problem came was, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, but I will shortly. Oh, yeah, boom, boom. We intuitively knew how to handle something that was baffling us 10 minutes ago. And so the solution is in the power. And this applies to when you're brand new, and it applies to when we've been around for a long time. What does Bill say to those of us that have been around a long time and we're encountering a problem? Go on to the meeting. The meetings don't seem as exciting. Something's going wrong in my life. He only has one answer. You know what the answer is? More spiritual growth. No, you grew up to here. Now you got to grow more. It's only one answer, and so that's what the solution, as I would interpret it, is. Power. Power. And so the story, the guy was right. He was going to give him a solution. The problem was it was the wrong higher power. But it was an exact analogy to our program. Exact. You just get the power and the problems are resolved. It's not our job to resolve the problems. It's our job to do God's work. and the problems are all resolved. So that's my shot on it. I'll
transfer over to you.
And now Norm Cosby will... your analogies and word pictures are just extraordinary. They just are extraordinary. Isn't that wonderful? Why do we have so much trouble? I mean, if there is that solution, why are we sitting out in this room with divorce problems and health issues and depression and checking accounts, $500 overdrawn, $35,000 in credit card bills, kids at home that we aren't quite sure what to do with, and why do we have those problems if we have the solution? And I think that that's one of the great questions. I think a lot of us disempower ourselves. I can tell you only from my own experience. It is my experience from my own actions and living of my life, and my experience from watching people that I've had the privilege to sponsor, is I think most of us come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we have a surrender experience of whatever depth we have. Some of them are profound, some of them are not quite so profound and they deepen later, some of them are not quite so profound and they never deepen. We have a surrender experience, and many of us, for the first couple of years of our sobriety, go through an enormous growth process. I don't think anybody can walk in here initially and hold what Sandy just said. It's too big. I mean, it is, you know, they might hear it in their heart, but, you know, which is where we would hear that anyways, not our heads. But, I mean, it's so big that you almost don't get it. I think most of us come in here and we have a plan. You know, my sponsor used to jokingly say, what I wanted was $10,000 and a new wife, okay? But most of us come in and we have a list of problems that if we resolve those issues, that would be really terrific. You know, if I really got a career going, if I straightened out things at home, or, you know, I mean, there's a list that if we could do those, you know, life would really be okay. And interestingly enough, most of us make very significant progress with those things over the first few years of our sobriety. What you find out is the same thing that most of us find out that are older, is that circumstantial resolution does not bring us the peace and happiness that we thought it would. The midlife crisis, what is the midlife crisis? You know, when you get to be, I'm 60, almost 61, you know, it's being 61 and realizing you're not going to climb the mountains that you thought you were going to climb. You're not going to be the president of this, or, you know. And the other thing is that the mountains you have climbed didn't make it for you. And so you do end up with the question, what is it all about? If I'm not going to be able to become what I thought I had to become to be okay, and what I've done isn't enough, what the hell is okay? What is it about, Elsie? And I think that most of us in our early middle sobriety run into a crisis. I think that we go through the enormous growth change and burst of energy in our very early sobriety, that activity and the fellowship and the grace that goes along with that. Many of us have a honeymoon period after the surrender where we just have this learning period where we're just like little sponges and we suck up, you know, we ask a question, we get an answer, we got an answer. But all of a sudden you're 2 years sober, you ask a question, you get an answer, you're not sure the person's right. You know, you're home. I mean, you're not. Your ego starts to reassert itself, and all of a sudden you're running the, you know. And I think what most of us do, most of us are sitting in this audience, and we could pass the test. We've got the booby prize. All of us have the answer. But we don't have the solution. We've got the information, but we don't have the principle alive. We don't know it in a way that makes a difference. We know it, but we don't know it in a way that makes a difference. And there you have to, I think, know it with your heart. You have to engage at a level that is deeper. Your intellect isn't enough. It's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. It is not enough. The choices that I think we continuously run up in life is you got a choice. You know, Chamberlain used to say you can have a God-centered life and suffer the consequences, or a self-centered life and suffer the consequences. You're either going to have your ego and intellect running the show, or you're going to be God-centered. Those are the choices. Now, when they're God-centered, the intellect's involved, it's just a junior partner. But when the ego is running the show, your mind is in charge of everything. Isn't that a thought? Okay. Okay. Now, for those of you who have tried to meditate in this room, you know, if you ever have tried to quiet your mind, you're going to find out something. Number one, you don't generate your thoughts. They just are like trains going through Grand Central Station. They arrive without any volition, without any choice. Once in a while, one has Velcro on it, and you engage it. And but that's true. And you aren't even the thinker, which most of us identify as the thinker. Most of us identify as a set of circumstances. We don't have the distinction between our life and our life circumstances. Most of what is weighing us down in the room is not our life. It's not who we are. It's the circumstances of our life. That's not who we are. The circumstances are not what's eating us up. The fact that we're separated from ourselves, from our true self, not the false self, from our true self. And that's what the program gets us connected with. When it gets us connected with the spirit of the universe, it brings us home. The process of recovery is a process of returning home. It isn't becoming someone else. It's becoming who you always have been and have not known. It is that, oh, yeah, yeah. It is that those moments that all of us have experienced in the meetings and in conversations with other people, those little glimpses that, yeah, I can do that. I mean, it is so hard, but most of us, the encouragement in the world today is to use your mind and to use your head and to be self-centered and that the answer is out there. And most of us are this detached head going about life, and we bring the movie with us. We're not experiencing life. We're bringing us wherever we go, and we've got the film running all the time. And that's, I mean, it's just a mind stream. I mean, you know, when a new person comes over to your house and you ask them how they are and they babble out what they are concerned about, I mean, it is just like they put their mind on loudspeaker. It is just like vomiting out this complex, painful angst that is going through their head, and that's their reality. Those thoughts, that pattern, is their reality. You go talk to Sandy, I think, with 40 years of sobriety, and he's letting those trains go through the station. It isn't like he doesn't have insecurities. It isn't like I don't have insecurities. It isn't like I don't get thoughts of financial insecurity or sexual insecurity or, you know, marital issues or children issues. I get those, but they are not my life. When I can do something about it and they're present, I engage them. When they don't, I let the train go through the station. Well, most of us have the back door closed. We just accumulate them, and that is our reality. Okay. You can't have a God-centered life with that head. If that is your reality, you cannot have the experience to me of the solution. You can memorize the words. That's the menu. People will starve to death who memorize the menu. Some people are trying to eat the menu. You laugh, but I'm telling you, that's what a lot of us in alcohol, we're desperate. I mean, you don't think you'd try to eat the menu? I mean, you don't think you'd try to memorize the words? It is, I mean, but the words point. The words point to God. They point to the power. They point to the changes that we have to make. And it's almost as if when you go to have the experience, the words drop away. And what is left is the experience. And that is the thing. I mean, and where are you going to get that message? You're not going to get it in the world. And where do you spend, if you are what you fill yourself full of, what are you filling yourself full of? I'm not trying to make you shave your head and sell books at the airport, but if you don't have a significant interaction in Alcoholics Anonymous with the book and meetings and the steps and your sponsor, if you don't have a significant anchoring, what are you filling yourself full of? Well, I assume it's work and television and, you know, whatever other hobbies we have, gambling, sex, obesity, you know, whatever else we happen to be running at the moment. But, I mean, all of us have a kind of a specialty that we, you know, got locked out in the garage. And,
how'd you know?
But if you're wondering why, if we really have the solution and it's that easy, most of us can't hear the music. And most of us can't hear the music because we memorize the words and we have the concepts but we're not having the experience. And I'm telling you, he's not kidding, and I'm not kidding when I say there is a solution. There is a way around and through whatever pain, whatever difficulty, whatever circumstances you're dealing with. They mostly are an illusion. And that when you get in touch with your core self, when you come home, I mean, it's the silliest thing in the world. You're not missing anything. There's nothing missing. You're not under-equipped. I mean, you didn't miss two or three lines when they sent you down here to live your life, like you don't have the right intellect or the right pieces. There are 6 trillion cells in your body right now doing millions of examinations to send calcium here and grow this there. And you are such a wonder, you would have absolutely no idea what a wonder you are, what a success mechanism you are. You're not missing anything in the business of being able to live your life. You're just detoured. We're stuck in a place, and we're trying to get our minds to resolve the issue to get us out. The answer is surrender. And, you know, how do you surrender? I mean, that's a hell of a question. Every time someone comes over to your house, the answer is to surrender. I think sometimes the older guys who can sit someone down and have a conversation and help create a clearing. When you said you go over to Sandy's and you talk to him about a problem and you almost always leave without the problem, I think what happens is they create a clearing. And they just go, oh, yeah, because nothing has happened to the circumstances. I mean, you go out to the car, not a thing has happened to the circumstances. You just get reminded, oh, yeah, I'm God's kid. I'm a prince, for Christ's sake. You know. I own the kingdom, and I'm worried about my checkbook. Oh, I forgot. You know, but it is, I mean, it is extraordinary. So I'll give it back to Sandy.
Thinking about how a prayer might go. You might sit down in the morning and you may go get on your knees and go, God, I got a job interview at 10:30. I haven't had a job in 6 months. And I really need this job, and it's something I'd really enjoy doing. Could you please help me get rid of my fears so that I can be creative and really create a good impression and do the best that I can when I go on the interview? I just ask you to please do that for me, and I'll check in with you at the end of the day and let you know how it went. Now, that would be a prayer. But if we added what we might call meditation, which is listening to the prayer, we might finish the prayer and then sit there in silence. We may hear something like this. Yeah, I heard your prayer. Why don't you take me with you on the interview? Why do you want to leave me here and go out there by yourself? You see how we're limiting ourselves? We got a plan, and then we go, here's the plan, God. Help me, and I'll be back. But I want to do it myself because I don't want to give you the credit all the time. You know, you go to meetings and you go, God, 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 God. What about me? Where am I in the equation? And this is kind of a struggle that we all have in this coexistence. Watch out, we'll talk about this. I don't want to get into that, the riddle of our existence. But we do have a coexistence that we have as a living in the material world and the spiritual world at the same time. And we have to accept this, that this conflict exists, and we'll talk about that later. But I think the one of the things that I find, I was talking to somebody right before we came back up here. Well, there's a couple of things. There was situations that I never knew I had choices in. When I was a teenager, if I was standing with six other teenage boys and another kid came up and he pointed right at me and he said, "You're ugly, your mother's ugly, and you're stupid, and so is she." And then my buddy said, "Are you going to let him get away with that?" I didn't know that I could say, "Yeah. Yeah, I am going to let him just be stupid and stand there. Yeah, I am going to let him get away with that. He's a real jerk. Yeah." I didn't know that I had the freedom to not do what the crowd was telling me. I didn't know I had a choice of seeing things differently. I didn't know that I could put being undisturbed at the top of the list. And that was where you are the winner. That it's not competition. It is remaining in this undisturbed place. Now, as far as maintaining this, I was somehow I ended up, Bob and I didn't plan to end up being speakers anywhere. We just came to meetings, and it somehow just happened. We just ended up that somebody said, "Well, would you come over and talk at our group?" And somebody over there was from Baltimore, and the next thing I'm over there, and I'm going, blah, 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 and they go, "Oh, yeah," some guy from Pennsylvania said, "Oh, well, I heard this young jerk over there in Baltimore, and maybe we ought to get him up at our little deal," and we go around, and that was what was happening to me. And in 1975, I'd been running around to these little things for about 5 years, and I was in Indiana with Wino Joe, and the Al-Anon speaker was Elsa Chamberlain. And she took a liking to me. She just, I don't know what it was, she just said, "Oh, God, that's so nice," or whatever. And she went back to Chuck. Now, I knew Chuck Chamberlain. I mean, everybody knew the word. You said Chuck Chamberlain, and it was like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." Because I had missed out on meeting Bill Wilson. Every year, Hal Marley would say, "Let's go up to New York, and you can meet Bill Wilson." And I don't have enough money. I don't have enough money to go to Washington to New York. And he said, "Well, he's going to die someday, and you're going to wish you had met him." Well, yeah, so I didn't. And, of course, it's my biggest regret. But Chuck Chamberlain then kind of jumped into the, the AA guru. So anyway, Elsa Chamberlain went back, and I didn't know this, but she went back and said to him, "I want you to ask Sandy Beach to talk at the Palm Springs Roundup," which is where Drop the Rock came from. And Chuck said, "Who?" "Oh, it's this guy I heard back there, and he's from Washington." "Well, give me a tape." "Well, he doesn't have any tapes. There's anything like that." "Well, I'm not inviting him out to the Palm Springs Roundup." And without that, and she said, "Well, you'd be sleeping alone." And so I'm sitting at home in Virginia, right outside of Washington. The phone rings, and I answer it, and he says, "Is this Sandy Beach?" "Yes, this is Chuck Chamberlain." And I went, "Yes, yes, 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 yes." And all he said was, "My wife told me I have to invite you to the Palm Springs Roundup." So anyway, I went out there, and so all these things happen, and so I sponsor all kinds of people, and I'm doing all that, and I said, "How did I get into this? And what the heck is all this?" And I was telling Bob, I finally realized what I've been asked to do. And if I were to encapsulate what my job is, it's the best job in the world. I've been assigned the job of going to all kinds of places and seeing all kinds of people to tell them the good news. That's my job, is to be the bearer of good news. And as I tell it, I believe it. This is why sponsorship is so important, because my mind is telling me all kinds of things about there's better things than AA, that this is, this book, it's so simple, you can improve on this, you could be doing that, but I can't say that to the new guy, and I can't say that at a convention. I have to stay with the message. And as I'm saying the message, the power of it is just lighting me up like a light bulb. I'm just sitting there going, da-da-da-da-da-da. And when I get through, I go, geez, this thing is amazing. This thing is amazing. And I have it for that day. And then my mind comes in, not as amazing as you could make it. Not as amazing as you could. You ought to start your own program. You ought to... But I can't say that to anybody. So I'm forced back to the message. Back. It's so simple. It's just there. And it's simply an opening of the channel. So that this thing... I have to open the channel, let this come out. And it is in this flow of energy out from us that we can experience it. See, this energy is already inside of us. The spirit is already there. But unless it flows out, you can't feel it. It's blocked. It's self-centeredness. Screw those people. I got to take care of myself. And so now it's, you don't even know this power exists. It is in the release that you can feel it. And so that's why it's so exciting to sponsor somebody. Because you got to go, oh, what are we talking about tonight? And you know, somebody will call me up and go, well, tonight, I forget. I got 20 people or whatever. They're doing one step a week. And, you know, somebody's coming over and I just go, now, what are we on tonight? And, you know, so they have to keep track. And I go, step 8. And I go, oh, God, he's coming over to talk about step 8. Then he sits down and I'm all ready to just go on and on and on and on. And so where have I been? I've been back in this damn thing. I've been back in there and get this stuff, and it's there, and it's true, and it's real. How do you prove it's true? Results. That's it. No other proof. There's no other proof. Results. And look over to AA. It's there. It's not a theory. It's real. You get to see it. It's not on a blackboard. Now, did you see step 1, see step 2? And now you can see, obviously, as a result of these, you have a spiritual awakening, right? You can see it. You can see it. You can't see it. You have to do it. And then you see the results. And when I see, God, I'm taking up all the time. One more story. this is what it feels like, sponsoring people and carrying the message. There's this, this minister is walking along. He's been a minister for many years. And he sees this young boy kind of crying. He's really sad. And he goes up to him and he says, what's the matter, son? He said, I got my final algebra exam tomorrow. And I try as hard as I can, I can't grasp algebra. Even with the book open at home, I can't do the homework and get it right. I'm at a total loss, and there's no way I can pass this test. My parents are going to be disappointed, and I'm just so sad about everything. And the minister looked at him. He said, son, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you about the power of God. I'm going to tell you this, that if you get enough faith and you pray hard enough, you will pass that test. And the little boy said, what? He said, you trust me, son. If you get enough faith and you pray hard enough, you will pass that test. And they separated, and probably about a week later, the minister happened to run into him again, and he said, hey, how did you do? And the little boy said, I passed. And the minister said, you passed? He said, yeah. I got all the faith that I could muster, and I prayed with all my heart. And I passed the test. And he ran off whistling and happy. And the minister said, holy shit. And sometimes I watch what happens to new people, and that's what I feel like saying. I just go, how the hell did that schizophrenic, depressed maniac... Look at him up there. He's making sense. He's blah, 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 blah. And I forget the power of this program. Anyway, that's... yeah.
Yeah, and I think everything in the world says to us that we have to be the source of our own power, and what we are channels. We're like sprinklers. You know, we don't look, you know, with very special designs, but we don't look very pretty unless water is going through. And most of us have our holes clogged. And that's one of the things that doing the work of the program unclogs the holes so that we can display the design. And your head does not see. All of us have this experience in meetings. I mean, it is, I guess we got 10 minutes. There's two things. One's a personal story. My son, Peter, I just talked to him yesterday, and he's in England, scared stiff. Peter was a guy who was just kind of a catastrophe, 60 miles an hour, head first, no helmet, spring-loaded. He's now got 13 or 14 years of sobriety, and he just got accepted to Oxford Business School, 32 years old. And he feels like he's way over his head, and he is. And there was a time in our lives when Linda and I, just to maintain our sanity, used to have to hold hands and pray every night for Peter. I mean, he looked like he was killing himself. Peter went to 6 colleges. He never got the concept of attending until he went to the 4th college. He got registry, but not attending. And so now, some of the changes he made late. But because he stayed sober, and because he matured late, so many of these young people today, they're 30 years old, but they're like 20 years old. They aren't 30 years old, but maturation-wise. And it is so unlinear that he is where he is, having the opportunity to do what he's doing. It is like impossible. If you could have walked in, Linda's at our bedroom while we were in tears, praying for Peter, I said, "Stop worrying, for God's sake. He's going to be at Oxford in 14 years." He's going to. I would have thought, without a second, Creighton sponsoring him for a while. I would have thought it was the prison at Oxford, Mississippi. It would not have occurred to me. It would not have occurred to me. And one of the other stories I want to tell you is about Creighton. Creighton lived in Minnesota for quite some time, and now he lives in Tennessee, I think. Mississippi. Creighton developed a health disease due to Agent Orange. He had and he's developing a kidney issue, and he's needed a transplant. And Creighton was on an airplane. I may not tell this exactly, but Creighton's on an airplane. And a stewardess comes down and said, "Would you like a drink?" Creighton shows her his AA medallion and said, "I don't think I'll be drinking today. I have to be home on Wednesday." You know, that kind of a response. And the gentleman sitting next to Creighton, Ryan, is a couple of seats away, and he sees Creighton show the medallion, and Ryan pulls the medallion out of his pocket and says to the stewardess he doesn't think he's going to have a drink either. And those two started talking. 3 or 4 days from now, Ryan is going to give Creighton his kidney. Creighton was particularly difficult to match because of some of the markers and some of the health experiences that he's had in Vietnam. He was far more difficult to match than a normal person, and Ryan matched him almost identically. My son Bill, who was 17 years of sobriety, moved to Europe for 4 years, and he was sober about 5 years at that time, and I supported him for 3 or 4 months. I told him that I wouldn't do it afterwards, and he worked at the World's Fair and needed a job, and he went and applied at the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, and nothing happened, didn't give him a job. So he goes to an AA meeting in Madrid, and the man who interviewed him is at the AA meeting. Bill is now not in a 3-piece suit. He's in a T-shirt and Bermuda shorts. And they go through the meeting. At the end of the meeting, the guy who interviewed him came over and says, "I'm really impressed with you. Why don't you come over and interview?" And Bill is wondering whether he should tell the man that he already has interviewed 2 days before. And Bill said, I have interviewed with you, sir. It was, you know. There are so many things happening in life that you can't see with your mind, that you can't feel with your fingers, that you don't know anything about, that you have so much power available to you in the living of your own life, and you don't get it. You are walking around with $1,000 bills crushed up in your pocket, and they're turning off your lights because you haven't paid your utility bill. You don't get it. I mean, there really is a solution. There really is a power. And that we're intended to be pipes, not the well. That when the power comes through us, we get to be the instrument. We get to play our music. And that each of us is an instrument, intact, fully constructed, nothing missing. And then what we've done is we've obscured that. We have added, you know, it's like we're a metallic instrument and we dragged it through the junkyard of life and we showed up in AA and it's a big metal ball with a bunch of metal that we have accidentally attracted it, and we dragged it through the junkyard of life, and through doing the steps we start to pry off pieces of junk, and little by little we get to start to get closer to the source of who we be. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Are we done with the hour yet?
Yeah.
12:30. I give you Sandy. I have to go to the bathroom.
Well, I don't know. The stuff I have in my mind now, I'm saving for the afternoon. So I think I'll just... tell you a couple stories, maybe. I'm going up next week to, not next, let's see, next month, on November 17th, to Washington, D.C., and I had a compatriot, Hal Marley, who passed away a few years ago, who got sober the same year I did. And he and myself and Ed Chandler, who's down in Texas now, were the class of 64 up in the Washington area. And we had dinner after we got to know each other for a while. We started having dinner once a month, especially in the years when we had 20 years to 30 years, somewhere in there. We had dinner almost every month. And Hal ended up, he was a retired Air Force fighter pilot, and was an air attaché to Poland in the Cold War, and had very interesting careers, went with OEO for a while, but ended up at the State Department as the director of the alcohol programs at the State Department. He would be calling ambassadors back to go to treatment, you know, that kind of a thing. And so he loved to operate up at the super high level. I used to kid him and say his only resentment was there's no class above first class so that he could be up there. And he was very close to Bob Pearson, who was the manager of the General Service Office at the time. And with his worldwide communication system at State Department, he was plugged in to every AA event on the planet. I mean, if I had a question, you know, do I know anybody in Peoria? And he would go, yes, Sandy, remember this Jack used to live here, now he's in Peoria, and he'd have his phone number. And it was like the internet in one guy, you know, as far as AA was concerned. And he preached gratitude. I mean, there's people all over the country that had attitude of gratitude pins, and he just would, Mr. Gratitude, Dr. Gratitude.
February 27th in the reflection.
Yeah, and that was in the thing the day he died. But the story I want to tell you is about Hal, that he was so plugged in that nothing happened in AA without him knowing it. I mean, when they're getting ready to plan the international, he knew where they were having it first so he could come around. Well, the international's going to be in Toronto. It's going to be, you know, whatever it was. And he just had to be the first. And then we'd be at the dinner, Ed and I, once a month, and each guy would treat and go to their favorite restaurant. And then we'd talk about AA, and it was always about what's going on and this and that. Well, I was at an AA group one night, and I took a chance, a raffle, and I won a 12 and 12. And I got home, and I was just thumbing through. I keep them, and then I can give them away to people. And so I was thumbing through this thing, and I went, God, look at this. What a weird thing. The thing had been screwed up by the printer. And the pages, some of the pages were out of sequence. They were back and forth. And something told me, keep it. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I knew this thing was going to come in handy. And then it dawned on me about 6 months later, and I said, I got to go find that 12 and 12. I want to see if in there's a place where, you know, on the pages, like a half a page where the step ends, and then you turn the page and another step starts, and it's out of sequence. So here was step 8 followed by step 11. So I bring the book to the dinner. And I put it on the table, and Hal, which is, what's that? And I said, I'll tell you after dinner. It's a big deal, Hal. This is the first volume. of the new 12 and 12. And, of course, he's looking at me like, what? I mean, he's very suspicious. So we have dinner, and we get through the meal, and I say, you know, Hal, I've been doing this step class. I don't know how I got into that, but I did a Saturday morning step class for 19 years. And, you know, you do it week after week. And he was well aware of that. And I said, Hal, I'm doing this thing for 12 years. And I said, about a year ago, I started through them, and it occurred to me they're in the wrong order. It was like I was being blasphemous, you know what I mean? What? And I said, I know, and I knew, and so I suppressed it. I said, that's ridiculous. I put it down. But it kept coming back, Hal. Every time I went through, it was clearer and clearer and clearer that they're in the wrong order. So I called Bob Pearson. Well, I could see the look on his face. You called Bob Pearson without checking with me first? You know... And I told him, I said, Bob, I'm having this crazy thing. It's happening to me. And he thought it was, you know, he dismissed it. But the more I talked about it, he said, well, I hear a few points over the phone. Could you type it up, your rationale for all of this? So I sent him in about 8 typewritten pages, Hal, and showing how the sequence should be changed. And he's still looking at me, you know, like, what? And you know something? They formed a committee. They ran it by the trustees. Like they could run it by without Hal knowing. And this is the new 12 and 12. And as you can plainly see, here's step 8. Followed by step 11. And Ed and I swear that for a millionth of a second, there was fear in his eyes. And he grabbed the book away from me. And he said, so that's just an anecdote about Hal Morrow. We're at the end of the time. Okay. We're there.